start. As you can see, that's my title, Sustainability, Empty Rhetoric, or a Bad Idea. And I'm basically going to be making two different arguments. And the first is about the word sustainability. And the second is about the ideas that it's used in argument. And what I want to claim first is that sustainability is an advertising slogan masquerading as an argument. That the function of that term is to make it sound as though certain policies and activities are obviously right and no reasonable person would object to them, while avoiding the hard problem of thinking about the human costs and benefits of different alternatives. That we live in a world of limited resources, and I don't just mean natural resources, human labor and knowledge are very valuable resources. In that world, you are always facing trade-offs. Achieving one good objective means achieving less of another, and the sustainability rhetoric makes it sound as though the answers are obvious. So then the question is, what does the word sustainable mean? And I want to start with what is in some sense the simplest definition, sustainable, capable of being sustained. And if you think about the way the term is used when people talk about sustainable agriculture, what do they mean? They mean farming in such a way that you could keep farming that way forever, that you're not using up anything in effect. And sustainability in that sense might be a reasonable objective if we lived in a static world. If we lived in a world where we could actually expect that whatever we're doing today, we will be doing 10 years and 50 years and 100 years from now. We do not live in such a world. We live in a world which is radically unstatic, in which circumstances are changing very quickly. And let me offer a couple of examples to illustrate what I think is a fairly obvious point. And that is, let's suppose we're having this conversation in 1880, and the main form of transportation at SCU and in the city of Santa Clara, other than walking, is horseback or horse-drawn vehicles. So in that world, a sustainable transport policy means making sure there are enough open fields growing grass and wheat and grain to feed all of those horses, and not covering up those fields with things like this building, which will result in a less sustainable transport system because we will have less of the particular resources needed for transport with 1880 technology. That would not have been a sensible thing to do. It would presumably have been sensible for the next 10 years or so, for longer than that, actually going back to 1880, but it would not make sense today for us to still make sure that we had enough open green fields so that however many horses we would now have could browse in them. That's not a sensible policy. Let me make the same point on a somewhat larger scale. Suppose we're thinking not about Santa Clara or Santa Clara University, but about the United States of America. And we say one of the really important objectives is that we can feed our people, that we have enough food to eat. And what are the inputs to producing food? Well, one of the really big inputs to producing food is farmers. All right. So therefore, a sustainable policy. Imagine that in 1880 people had thought about sort of national economic policy the way they do nowadays, which fortunately for them they didn't, but suppose they had, and they had said, all right, we've got to have some kind of a program, whether government, private, don't worry about it, which makes sure that we have sustainable agriculture. And while part of that, of course, is how we do the farming, another part of that is keeping enough people on the farm so that we will be able to grow the amount of food our population needs. Now, in 1880, 48% of the labor force was farmers. So if we had really followed a policy aimed at sustainable food production, that would mean that we would have had to make sure that there weren't any jobs pulling people off the land, and then we still had 48% of the labor force instead of 3%, which is roughly the current figure. And again, that would have been a crazy thing to do. And I think, I'm not saying anybody advocated that. I'm saying we just think about the word sustainable, which sounds like such a nice, innocent, obviously good word. In a changing world, it is a very unwise policy. So let me go on. When I made this point originally on my blog in the early response to hearing about this program, various people objected that wasn't what sustainability meant, and they pointed me at a web page which had somebody's standard definition. Later, when I raised the question with people here, I got pointed at some SCU web pages which had information, and I ended up with two different definitions, a short one and a long one. Let me start with the short one. Meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. And that, again, sounds sort of, when you look at it, obvious. Who could be against meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations? And the problem, of course, is that either it is too easy to be interesting or it's impossible. Let me explain what I mean by that. Insofar as what we mean by the ability of future generations to meet their needs is the ability of future generations to do the things that they think valuable, that they think are worth doing, the more resources available to them, the more they will be able to do that. Every barrel of oil that we pump and burn today is one barrel that will not be available tomorrow or 50 years from now or 100 years from now. So unless you believe we can meet the needs of the present while consuming zero oil, there is no way of meeting the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations. It may not compromise it very much. It might turn out that oil is not very important in 20 or 50 or 100 years. It's entirely possible. But surely something we use today will be of some value then. And so unless we're willing to use nothing at all, we're pretty much stuck with this as an impossible objective. Now, the obvious response, and the one that I think a intelligent person who was in favor of this definition and hadn't thought things, in my view, through carefully enough would make, is I'm not talking about giving people what they want. I'm talking about giving people what they need. And that, again, it seems to me is a, I guess I would say that's, again, an advertising slogan masquerading as an argument. What do people need? Well, need sounds like it means biological needs, you know, enough food, water, shelter. But if that's right, that's an awfully low standard. We don't appreciate, living in the luxurious, rich society, just how low standard it is. In 1900, the median real income of the U.S., that's real income as allowing for price changes, was half the current poverty level. So that means that half the population was living at or below half what we consider a poverty level of income. Not only were those 100 million people not all dying of starvation, which you might think would be what was happening if they didn't have their needs met, a million people a year were crossing the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean, and a few of them the Rio Grande, in order to come into a world where that was the condition. And they weren't coming to be at the top of the income distribution. Right? Most of them were coming to work in sweatshops and be farm laborers and do the sorts of things that new immigrants now and then, only then they had the good fortune to be legal immigrants, which made life a little easier. It'd be nice if we would return to that, but that's another argument. Do. So when you really think about it, the conclusion I came to many, many years ago is that everybody really believes in his heart that there is a level of income above which spending is mostly wasteful luxury and below which it's really essential. And that's about his level of income. Sometimes, you know, if you have sort of ambitious tastes, maybe it's twice your level of income. But it's somewhere around there. Because those are the things that you are used to seeing as important to you. And that once you give up this idea that there's some objective, narrow set of needs that people want, then the real question is, can we get people today, can we arrange matters so that people today get the things that matter to them without compromising the ability of people in the future? The answer is no, we can't. Maybe we can figure out, we can take account of their future needs. We can say to ourselves, how can we best achieve our objectives while imposing the lowest possible burden on people in the future? And that's a perfectly sensible way to think if you care about people in the future, and at least those of us who are parents surely do, and presumably some who aren't parents do too. But this, again, really becomes a slogan which, as far as I can tell, has no real content to it. All right, let me go to the long version. I really like this long version. I think anybody who takes it seriously ought to have his head examined. I'm being a little unfair. But when you see that many long, fancy words, a dynamic state in which global ecological and social systems are systematically, not unsystematically enhanced. We can't enhance things unsystematically. Sustainable development is often defined, we're now back where we were before, as that which meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to do things. Sustainability is often evaluated using the triple bottom line for ecological, social, and economic health, because economic considerations are such a large and central aspect of social systems and vital to the continued operation of individual organizations. There is only one word in that which contains all of the content, and that's the word health. All right? What we need is ecological, social, and economic health. What does health mean? Well, take economic health. I've been rereading George Orwell's letters and essays. I'm a fan of George Orwell, even though I disagree with his politics. And it's perfectly clear that he would say with great confidence that economic health means democratic socialism, that he's sure that capitalism has to lead to horrible results. He died in a little after World War II. He didn't actually see various of his predictions falsified. He is sure that totalitarianism has very, very ugly results, and he's smart enough to realize that part of the danger of socialism is that it can easily lead to a totalitarian system, but he thinks maybe we can, if we're really lucky, avoid that. On the other hand, if you asked my friend Adam Smith what economic health would be, he would have said a society in which government doesn't play a very large role in the economy, in which most decisions are made by private individuals buying and selling, trading, making stuff, and so forth. Very different pictures. If you asked Joseph Stalin, you would presumably get a still different answer, different from both of those. So that when you use a term like economic health, you are implying, using that term, that there is a clear, objective meaning that everybody would agree to about what's a healthy economy, and thus burying all of the important arguments. I don't know what the arguments are in ecology, but for social health, it's exactly the same thing. So if you think about one of the currently hot issues is gay rights, there are surely millions of people in America who say, well, one part of social health is that there aren't any homosexuals, because we know that homosexuality is bad and evil and corrupting and has all sorts of effects. Other people would say one part of social health absolutely clearly is that homosexuals should have the same rights as everybody else, including the right to marry each other. You don't settle that argument by saying you're in favor of health, of social health in that case. So again, it seems to me that what you really have is rhetoric pretending to be an argument. It's just this time it's buried in a bunch of pretentious verbiage. I should have lifted, there's a wonderful quote from Smith somewhere in politics, sorry, from Orwell somewhere in Politics in the English Language about the use of long words to sort of befog issue. It would be fun, actually, to see how many of the words here are from Latin and how many from Anglo-Saxon, because he suggests that when you don't want people to act, when you want to say something without really being clear about it, you use Latin-based words instead of Anglo-Saxon-based words. That would be a digression, but an interesting one. All right, so that's my basic point. And then you say, what does it actually mean? Not what is the idea, but how is it used? And the answer is it's an advertising slogan for whatever policies are currently popular with the environmental movement. That's what it actually comes down to, although not what it claims to be. All right, so the second half of my argument, the first half of my argument is that it's empty rhetoric. And the second half, it's a bit of an overstatement for me to claim it is a bad idea, but let me say rather that it can be that some of the ideas that calling the fact that something goes in the package called sustainability does not tell you whether it's a good or bad idea. That at least one of those things in the package was and is a very bad idea indeed, since it consists of promoting world hunger, a fact that Al Gore, to his credit, finally recognized and published. I should say I think much better of Gore than I used to, because admitting you're wrong is really hard. And in this case, he did. We'll come back to that later. I'm thinking, of course, of the biofuels project. The propaganda for it was, we're going to be using renewable resources. That's exactly sustainability, rather than depletable resources. And, of course, the real effect of biofuels is you divert agricultural production out of feeding people into producing fuel. And what do you think happens to the world price of food when you do that? And I think Gore recognized that as well as various other people. I'll be coming back to that because it's an interesting example. But let me go talk instead of talking right now about that, I'll come back. I want to talk about what's in some sense the crown jewel of the current environmental movement, and that's global warming. That's sort of the biggie that people most talk about. And I have no expertise in climate science, even though I do have a doctorate in physics, which I guess occasionally lets me see that arguments are wrong, but that certainly doesn't let me tell me what's going to happen to the climate. And so for the purposes of this talk, and probably in general, I'm willing to accept the IPCC estimates, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, I think it is, who are the UN-associated people who run various models and try to estimate what the effect of human action on climate. And they produce a range of different estimates, as they ought to, since there are a lot of things we don't know about the future. But I'm going to take what's roughly speaking the middle of their range, which is an increase over 100 years of about 3 degrees centigrade in world climate and about a foot in sea level. And they've got models that run less than that. They've got models that run more than that. But I think that's close enough to sort of the center of it to do. And then the question is, what are the implications of those changes for human beings? And people talk, the rhetoric is as if that's a catastrophe. That's something we've got to do everything we possibly could at whatever cost to prevent. Now you think about it for a minute. Well, let's think about agriculture. Over 100 years, every farmer on the globe will have changed the crop he grows at least once. Not necessarily from rice to wheat. It might be from one strain of rice to another strain of rice. But it's not like we live in a world where people are stuck growing the same things forever. If, hard to believe that you'd need more than one change to switch from a variety that worked at one average temperature to a variety that worked at a temperature 3 degrees higher. But suppose you need more than one, all right? Every 30 years, that's 1 degree centigrade, every 30 years roughly. And having to switch your crop every 30 years is not much of a hardship because you'll probably do it anyway because someone will have a better crop available or what you were growing will lose its popularity on the market or something else will change. We're in a changing world. We're not in a static world. How about where people live? Well, a foot of sea level really is not very much. I like to point out that the Dutch, with medieval technology and medieval resources, farmed land below high tide. They built dikes. They pushed back the ocean a little bit because they needed land very badly. And they're still doing it. Well, it's hard to believe that if the Dutch could do that 800 years ago, that with bulldozers and concrete and everything we have, you can't accommodate to a 1 foot rise in sea level when you've got 100 years, a century to do it in. And if you don't accommodate, a 1 foot is not a very large increase. It happens that one of the sort of fun things you can do if you like poking around the web is to find a number of web pages which have world maps, which you can zoom in on, showing the effect of sea level rises of different levels. And assuming that this machine... Yeah, the machine has got it. It's even got Firefox. How nice. I like Firefox. All right. Let's take a look at the map. That's a 7-meter one. Let me start at zero, because that's our baseline. Just a minute. There's something wrong with the way this is set up. Go to that, and now let go to... down. I bet that'll do it. Yeah, 0 meters. And I'm going to look at Florida, because Florida is one of the places that people like to say horrible things are going to happen with global warming, and it'll all be flooded and all stuff like that. So let's zoom in on Florida. I've got to pull it down. I should say the Caribbean is another place people worry about. But let's just look at Florida. It's a place that some of us might want to retire to when we get old or something. Zoom in a little bit further so we can actually see what we're... That's Florida. That's Florida with 0 meters of sea level rise. That's Florida with 1 meter of sea level rise. 3 times the IPCC estimate. 3 feet instead of... Can you see the difference? I can't. All right. Now, if you get enough sea level rise, you can see the difference. All right. If you take that up to 3 meters, we're now talking about 10 times, now you're beginning to see water coming into the sort of southwestern tip. I think this has grown a bit. Not much along this edge, a little bit. But you're really talking, when you're talking about a foot or 2 feet or 3 feet of sea level rise, you're talking about tiny effects on a global scale in terms of how much land is actually available to grow stuff on. Not zero effects. There are going to be a few places. If you live in Bangladesh, it's going to be a real nuisance. If you live in Bangladesh on the coast, because Bangladesh is densely populated, poor, and very, very low-lying. But even Bangladesh, over 100 years, I bet they can build a 1 foot dike too. Maybe even a 5 foot dike. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if the per capita income of Bangladesh is higher than the per capita income of the Dutch in the 12th century. I don't know. But the basic point anyway is that you are not talking about a huge effect, even though people routinely talk as if they were. And that's the URL if you want it. I think it's sort of neat. Let me go on. Actually, I should really go back because I was going to make that point a little bit later. It's a good quote. My wife's a geologist, and you get a sort of an odd view of the world when you're living with a geologist. When we were in England and we looked at, I think it was Hadrian's Wall or maybe Trajan's Wall that the Romans built to keep the Picts out of England, and my wife's comment was how new it looked. Because, of course, from her standpoint, I mean, 2,000 years, that's an instant. right, in geological time. Well, one of the things that you realize when you associate with geologists is that Earth's climate is not stable. That we are at the moment in an interglacial. You all realize we're living in an ice age. Right? Roughly speaking, the past million years is an ice age. An ice age consists of long periods when there are continental glaciers coming from down from the North and South Pole and covering lots of land, interspersed with short periods called interglacials where the glaciers recede. We're in one of them. Indeed, if you just look at average lengths in the past, we're at the end of an interglacial. Because this one has lasted longer than most of them have. But we don't really, I mean, climate science just isn't good enough. It's not like we have a good theory of why they last as long as they last. I've even seen a sort of interesting argument a long time ago saying that the long interglacial is the result of human effect on climate. Not our effect, not carbon dioxide, but effects of the invention of agriculture a long time ago. That for some reason I've forgotten that shifted the balance a little bit and kept things a little bit, got things warm longer than they would. I don't know if that's right or not. The point is that over and over again, in the last million years, the climate of the Earth has ranged from half a mile of ice over the current locations of Chicago and London to hippos in the current location of Chicago, in the current location of London. I don't know. I'm quoting my wife, so I don't know if there were hippos in Chicago or not. But there were hippos somewhere around what was going to be London at the time. So that's a big change compared to what we're talking about with global warming. The human race survived those changes over and over again, and we did it with no technology more advanced than fire and flint. That's what we had, and we're still here. So it seems to me very hard to believe. Now, I don't want to overstate the case. We don't understand climate very well. Maybe the IPCC estimates are much too conservative. Maybe one of the various catastrophic things will happen that some people have speculated about, and maybe we're going to have a 20-degree centigrade increase in global warming. That's going to be a real problem. All right, if that happens. But, of course, maybe we're going to drop off the interglacial next Thursday and we're going to be trying to pump all the CO2 into the air we can in order to slow down the advance of the glacier. We just don't know. But if you put the question not in terms of all of the things that might happen, but in terms of the best guesses we currently have of what's going to happen, that, I think, I'm willing to take the IPCC on that as good as we got. And on that basis, it seems to me that what we can expect from global warming is way, way short of catastrophe. It's something, I'm not even sure it's bad. One of my arguments I sometimes make as an economist is that economists who want to argue for something like to talk about externalities. An externality is an effect of my action on you. And if they want to argue in favor of something, give a whole list of positive externalities, of ways in which I do something that benefits other people, we've got to subsidize it. When they want to argue against something, they give you a list of negative externalities, ways in which it harms other people, we've got to ban it or tax it or something. Almost never, oddly enough, it would be a little surprising if everything humans did either had only positive or only negative effects. And yet almost never do people try to actually add up both of them. Which is what you ought to do just in straight economics. My first published work in economics, which was on population policy, was one in which I tried to estimate the external costs of having a baby. The ways in which if one person had a baby, other people were better or worse. And add them up. I couldn't sign the sum. The numbers were sufficiently indefinite that I could not say whether on net one more baby made the rest of the world better off or worse off. And yet the world was full of people then who were certain they made it worse off. And I should add, there have always been people, and if there aren't at the moment, there will be 10 years from now, and we're 50 years now, who are sure that more babies are good, which is why you have countries that give bonuses to parents who have more children. But the right, insofar as you can do it, what you've got to do is to try to figure out all the effects of both. Similarly with global warming. One of the things that I don't think I ever saw in a headline was that at one point, and I'm not sure if it was the latest IPCC report or the one before it, somewhere buried in that was a reference to the effect of global warming on agricultural output. And it was that it would increase output for the first 1 to 3 degrees. It wasn't clear to me if they meant all the way up to 3 or if they meant we aren't sure if it's only true for the first degree or up to the third degree. I don't know if that result was right, but it's not absurd. All right, and think about Canada. Canada's 100 miles wide, right? 3,000 miles in one direction, 100 miles the other. But beyond that, nobody can do anything. Obviously, I'm oversimplifying. But if you just think about, a little global warming would be 150 miles wide. That's a big benefit to agriculture. Canada's a big agricultural production. Siberia, same story. All right. Norway, Sweden, there are large parts of the world which are unlivable because they're too cold. and global warming is probably going to be good for that. Now, every time you make such an argument, it says, oh, no, but global warming is going to reduce rainfall. Yeah, it's going to increase rainfall, but so we're going to have a problem with floods and have a problem. There is no reason, maybe there's a reason if you're a theist, but there's no reason, no scientific reason to believe the present conditions of Earth are optimal. It's not like our present climate was designed by us for our comfort. So it is surely true that if you change anything, some people will be worse off, some people will be better off. But there's no particular reason to think that the current global climate is better for us than 1 3-degree warmer. Might be, might not be. It's true that if you change fast, there are problems, because we've adapted our life to the world the way it is. So if things get warmer, there are going to be places which people it's warmer, places people didn't have air conditioning, have to put in air conditioning. Places where the crops people are used to growing won't work. Where the land they used to cultivate is the wrong land now, and so forth. Ditto if it gets colder. But again, we're talking about a change over a century, not a change over a year. And over a century, practically everything we do gets cycled at least once. I was mentioning crops, houses. I happen to live in a house that's over 100 years old, which is very rare in this part of the world. Very lovely house. I was very lucky to get it. But most houses within 100 years will have been torn down and replaced. Well, if sea level rises a little bit, when you replace them, you'll build 50 feet farther from the current shore. That's not a huge adjustment problem. So the argument I want to make here is that we're not talking about large. We may be talking about cost. I'm not even sure we're talking about net cost. We're not talking about huge cost. How about the other side? What does it take to prevent global warming? I should say, I don't think we can prevent it. I'll come to that later. But suppose you could. And pretty clearly what the program being pushed is to drastically reduce the world's use of fossil fuel. If you believe, as seems very likely, I think people tend to be overconfident in most of these conclusions, but it seems very likely that indeed the reason global temperatures have been gradually drifting up for whatever it's been, the last century or so, is human production of carbon dioxide. Assuming that's right, I'm going to put aside various geoengineering projects, which are not likely to happen for other reasons, but if that's right, the approach to solving it and the approach embedded in all of the sustainability talk, as far as I can tell, is to drastically reduce the use of fossil fuel. What does that mean? Oil costs money. If there were cheap, easy substitutes, if it was really true that if instead of digging an oil well, you put up a windmill, and you got more power at less cost, people will be doing it already. Right? People don't like wasting money. Even non-environmentalists don't like wasting money, at least if it's not their own money. So what that means is that if you want to shift a big way away from fossil fuels and to do it at all quickly, you have to do one of two things. Either you have to shift to more expensive ways of producing power, or you've got to greatly reduce your consumption of power. And I don't see any third alternative. Now, over a long enough time, if you're lucky, technology might produce better solutions. A point I'll come back to at the end. It's entirely possible that 30 years from now, fossil fuel will no longer be used for power generation. Because solar power is a relatively new technology. Its costs have been falling. If they keep falling, and we don't know they will, you could have a world where it was simply cheaper to use solar power than fossil fuel, and then with no ideology or environmentalism or anything else, people will mostly stop using fossil fuel. But putting that aside, regardless of what's happening now, it's really either greatly raise costs or greatly reduce usage. For the U.S. and Europe, an increase in cost would be unfortunate. It would make us all a little poorer. It's not a huge thing. But one of the things people have somehow managed not to pay enough attention to is that over the last 20 years, what people used to regard as the one great problem of the world and made great efforts with no success at all to solve has been solving itself. And that problem is the poverty of the third world. All right? If you look at the history of India and China, right, to take those as the two big countries, from the roughly a little after the end of World War II on, the Indian government accepted the advice of Western economists, economic development people, which was that if you want to make yourself into a modern country, you need central planning. You need five-year plans. In order to develop your industry, you've got to put up big tariff barriers against foreign autos and build autos in India at a cost of $15,000 instead of buying secondhand autos in America at a cost of $500. We're too poor to afford the $500 automobiles because we need anything. Everybody knows that an auto industry is a sign of a developed country. And India basically followed that policy. The people in the Indian government were pretty happy with it because it put lots of power in their hands, which meant that while they were explaining that they were doing all this for the good of India, they were doing it in air-conditioned luxury hotels in Delhi. And nothing happened. India stayed, I exaggerate, basically India stayed poor, except for people who had enough sense to leave India, and they did very well for themselves. During the same period, China got its advice from the other direction. Their advice, insofar as it wasn't their own ideas, was basically coming from Stalin's Russia. And they followed a roughly similar policy, and they stayed poor. Well, they, unlike India, they also killed a lot of people. That's something in the millions starved as a result of some of those policies. But basically, they did not, in fact, turn into a modern society. Then, about 20 or 30 years ago, for various reasons, the views in those countries shifted. And both countries moved a considerable distance, though not nearly as far as I would think they should have, towards something more like a market society with private means of production, private buying and selling, and so forth. And since then, they've started getting, well, rich would exaggerate, they've started getting less poor. That instead of worrying about China as how will they feed themselves or India, we worry about China as a competitor to America. Isn't that terrible? We might have somebody else as rich as we are. How could we stand that? And economic development takes power. If we were somehow able, unfortunately we're not, but if we were somehow able to get the people in India and China to do what the opposition to global warming says they have to do, that would mean ending the most successful war on poverty since, I guess, free immigration into the U.S. was probably the world's most successful war on poverty. But the second most, well, this is more people, so maybe the most successful one ever. Because it would mean slowing or reversing economic development because one of the major inputs to doing stuff would have suddenly become much more expensive or much less available. And we would be telling the Chinese, if you want to develop, you are going to have to spend a fortune building nuclear reactors, building windmills, buying solar cells from us or from somebody else, or maybe making them yourself. You're good at making stuff. And that would not be advice they would be very happy with, or that they should be very happy with. Because getting 2 or 3 billion people out of poverty is a lot more important, in my view, than keeping the world's temperature from going up 3 degrees centigrade. Let me go on. So my basic point here, I don't want to overstate it. My basic point here is that doing the things necessary to seriously slow global warming is at best a debatable project. I think it's probably worse than debatable. I think it's a bad idea. But at best, it's a project which really requires some thought and consideration and argument and looking at costs and benefits of all the things, not the label in sustainability. Good stuff means you've got to do it. Let me now go on to the case which I think is clearer, and that's biofuels. And biofuels were pushed on the grounds that it was sustainable, that by using biofuels you don't have to use up your oil, you can instead grow your fuel. Sounds like a great idea if you believe in sustainability, but pretty obvious. It was also supposed to reduce CO2 usage, and I gather from stuff I've read that that's a little dubious at this point. That people who've tried to analyze it and look at all of the consequences and what you have to do to process it and so forth think maybe it doesn't reduce CO2. I don't know if that's right or not. But what is entirely clear is that when you divert large amounts of agricultural output out of food and into fuel, you raise the price of food. And raising the price of food doesn't matter very much to American consumers because we don't spend a very large part of our budget on, as it were, the raw material of food. As you're spending money on the restaurant, you're spending money on the people who prepare your TV dinner and so forth, but the total amount we're actually spending on corn and grain and stuff is not a very large fraction of it. It is a large fraction, however, for people in Africa and India and China, for the poor parts of the world. And that's where the project to save the world was, in fact, a project to promote world hunger. And as I had said before, Al Gore finally recognized that. I'm going to quote him some more a little bit in a moment because I think there are some interesting lessons in what he said, more of what he said. But basically, that was what was a bad policy. And it was a result, again, of a lot of things. Probably a result, obviously, of lobbying by the agricultural interests, because the other thing, other than promoting world hunger, the other thing it does is promote agricultural income by raising the price of foodstuffs, which is what they're producing. All right, let me go on to talk about what seems to me the more general problem with this project, with some other projects as well, but I want to take environmentalism in particular. Not all of environmentalism, but with a lot of it. And that is that a lot of it, and global warming is probably one of the clearer cases, involves paying costs now for benefits that you think you're going to get in the distant future. And that is a very dangerous policy because the world is uncertain. Other reasons as well, but that'll do it. If you're talking about a period as long as a century, we have very little idea what humans are going to be doing 100 years from now or what the world will be like. Somebody, I made a point like this on my blog, and someone said, well, look, Jules Verne predicted it. He, in such and such a book, he described the world in 2100 pretty accurately. Of course, he thought it was going to take 1,000 years to get there, which would be sort of a nice example of not predicting it very successfully. So that then gets me to finally the quote I was giving and kept not giving. Prediction is hard, especially about the future, which is supposed to be Yogi Berra. And let me run through some real examples. And I will start with Stanley Jevons, who was a very important 19th century economist, one of the handful of people who really did an important stage in the invention of modern economics. For anybody who knows economics, he was one of the original marginalists, the people who created the sort of approach to economics we now use, along with several other people. But he did something else that made him famous, I think a little earlier than that, and that is he wrote a book on the coal question. Oh, sorry? I thought I had a quote from him. I guess I don't have a quote. I just mentioned him. And he estimated in, I think, 1865 that by about 1915, England would be seriously running out of coal and very serious economic difficulties as a result, which didn't seem to happen. Let me go on to my friend George Orwell, who is somebody, again, who I think highly of. 1946. During both the Depression and World War II, birth rates were very low for what are now fairly obvious reasons, and people were worried about it. That's England. England's current estimate for England is that by 70 years from when he wrote, the population will be 65 million people. All right, so he was just extrapolating. Extrapolating what had been happening for the last 15 years or so, as they were going to get that going. He was a very smart guy, but he was very badly wrong. Let me go on to the example that people who criticize this stuff like to make, and that's Paul Ehrlich. He was a very prominent environmental writer, and he wrote a book in 1968 in which he said, "The battle to feed all of humanity is over. In the 1970s, the world will undergo famines. Hundreds of millions of people are going to starve to death in spite of any crash programs embarked upon now." What in fact happened in the 1970s, per capita calorie consumption in the third world continued its upward trend, which had been on more or less since the end of World War II, which is as far back as our data go. So he's completely wrong. And he was completely wrong on a sort of a confident, whatever we can do, and catastrophic scale. And let me finally come to the latest one, which I only came across quite recently, and that's something from the United Nations Environment Program back in 2005. They estimate that about 50 million people by 2010 will be environmental refugees. The number of environmental refugees from deforestation and desertification as well as climate change was likely to exceed and so forth. It could lead to 50 million people. Well, 2010 came, and a reporter who had seen this number said, let's see if it's true. Let's see what happened. And it happened that they not only made this statement, they were also so imprudent as to publish a map. And the world map which showed where the problems were going to be. And so the reporter looked at census data, and it turned out that a number of the Caribbean islands, which were one of the places supposed to have problems, had had recent censuses. And every single one of these islands, which were supposed to be being depopulated by environmental refugees, population was higher than it had been back when that statement was made. also true of the coastal cities in China, which are also part of that story. Story keeps going, though, because after he published this in some very obscure publication, various less obscure publications picked up the story because it was a good story. Here you have a prediction which is falsified. And what happened was that if you clicked on the URL which used to have, which when he wrote his article had this map, here is what you got. They took down the graphics, and they didn't say, we've taken this down because we discovered it's wrong. They said, no, you've made a mistake. You clicked on the wrong URL. But that's not all they did. They didn't get 50 million refugees in 2010, but there's a civil solution to that. Coming in 2020, 50 million environmental refugees. All right, sorry, go back a minute. Because I want to point out that there are, in a sense, several different problems with large costs now for benefits in the distant future. One of them you just don't know. One of them is that with the very best will in the world, you may find you've done exactly the opposite of what you need. You may find you've tried to deal with global warming when the problem is global cooling or vice versa. Or more plausibly, you've tried to deal with underpopulation when the problem is overpopulation or vice versa. That I don't know how many sort of people, at least of the age of students here, appreciate just how long a string of false catastrophic prophecies have been made, say, in my lifetime by the environmental movement. And the Ehrlich quote is a favorite one because it's so obviously wrong. But there are a lot of others where people were saying, if you don't control your population, terrible things will happen. And the terrible things didn't happen. You know, some of the countries were poor before, they stayed poor. They didn't get any poorer. And some of them, like India, actually gradually got noticeably richer. So one problem is just you'll make mistakes. But the other problem is you don't have any feedback. That you do something, you don't know if it did any good. In a world where you don't have feedback, it is very tempting for people to use your arguments to achieve not your goal, but theirs. To say, you have to do such and such, or terrible things will happen in 100 years. And such is going to raise my income. That's sort of a nice feature of it as it happens. And we don't see anything happen. Well, 100 years haven't passed yet. So I want to go back to Gore, because Gore's comments are really very interesting. And let me take the second one first. The second one is, one of the reasons I made that mistake, he's talking about his support for biofuels. I should say he now thinks that a future biofuel technology using cellulose, which isn't used for food, would still be a good thing, but that the one they actually promoted was a bad thing. One of the reasons I made that mistake is that I paid particular attention to the farmers in my home state of Tennessee. And I had a certain fondness for the farmers in the state of Iowa because I was about to run for president. All right? It's an entirely believable confession, but it's to his credit that at least after the fact he could see it. That he, I'm pretty sure, really is an environmentalist. He really believes in this stuff. But at the same time, it's very tempting to distort the conclusions of your ideology in the direction to achieve your private goals, such as getting elected president. Especially because I'm sure that he, like other candidates, believes that his private goals in the national interest, believes that he would be a very good president. Very few people have run for president, too, I think, who didn't believe that. All right. So one problem is that when the actual effects are invisible, it is tempting to advocate the things that will serve your own interest while supporting them with future promises. But there's a second point. It wouldn't be so bad if once Gore saw the facts, he could snap his hand in the biofuels program, which is fair. It's not going to happen. As he says, it's hard once such a program is put in place to deal with the lobbies that keep it going. Because while part of the reason for biofuels, the sort of rhetorical reason for biofuels, was sustainability, the other half, and I think politically the big half, was the agricultural vote. And, you know, the Republicans are noticeably less enthusiastic about environmentalism than the Democrats. But I will be very pleasantly surprised if the current House of Representatives repeals the biofuels program. Because Republicans are at least as interested in votes from farm areas as Democrats are. And the biofuels program is a subsidy, among other things, to American farmers. I should say, the same thing happened with other ideological justifications long before. The American Farm Program, for a very long time, has been a program whose purpose was to raise the price of food in order to buy the votes of farmers. It's just that now they had an environmentalist justification instead of whatever other justification they were using 50 years ago.
What environmentalists were in favor of that?
When it happened, Gore was. He just said so.
That's a politician.
You don't think Gore is an environmentalist?
A great percentage of the environmental community was against growing ethanol.
And others were for it. And others were for it. But the rhetoric of environmentalism was part of what made it possible. I'm not... The point I'm making is not about people. It's about ideas. And I think Gore's against it now, to his credit. So I'm not saying all environmentalists are stupid. I'm sure some environmentalists see problems with things like this. And I'm sure there are some environmentalists who, you know, would disagree with me only on the things where we could, where they could make a good argument for their side of the case. And there's some where I wouldn't disagree. I mean, to take a trivial example, which only one person in the audience is likely to be familiar with, this university has installed in the men's restrooms water-free urinals. They work. They don't smell, and they don't use water. Well, if, as I suspect is the case, the real long-run cost of those is lower than the traditional fashion, then whoever it was who invented, designed, and bought those things was achieving an environmental objective and doing good on net. And similarly, I think, you know, if all environmentalism was doing was pushing people to think about these questions, pushing engineers to say, is there a way of making a better solar cell? Well, they probably won't, because there are other people thinking about it too, so it's got to be a hard problem. But that's fine. It's when it becomes a project to say, as Ehrlich said back in 68, we've got to get people to have fewer children, and if they won't do it voluntarily through taxes and things, we've got to do it by force. Well, I'm very fond of my kids, and I'm glad I got to have them. That's a big cost. And as I say, we're not really going to be able to make China and India poor, because they're not going to do what we tell them to. But in a certain sense, that's what the ideology is arguing for, and that's where you have to be willing to act. I'm not saying that when you think about the human cost, you'll always conclude the project is wrong. Maybe second-generation biofuel is a good idea. I don't know. Don't know enough about it. But you have to think about that, and it seems to me that using a slogan like sustainability tends to discourage the sort of serious thought. Not that nobody does think about it. I should say, when I wrote my piece on population, which would have been, about 1972, called Laissez-faire in Population, the Least Bad Solution, why did I write it? The head of the Population Council, who was not a free market libertarian type, but was a nice, smart guy, said to himself the same thing I said to myself when I looked at the plans for this whole program a few days ago. We're only getting one side of the argument. Everybody who writes about population knows it's bad and knows the government should do something about it. So he went to me and he said, would you be interested in writing something on the other side? And I did. And he published it as a pamphlet. He's a good guy. Berylson, I think, was his name, if I remember correctly. He probably isn't alive anymore because that was a long time ago. I should say, he also had a good sense of humor. Well, I'm running out of time, so I won't tell you the story. I'll tell you later after the thing is over. All right. Anyway, so I think I've made those points. What ought to be done? What's the appropriate response? And the first response is to abandon the rhetoric of catastrophe, because the real function of the rhetoric of catastrophe is to scare people out of thinking, to get them to say, we've got to do it right now, let's argue about it. And that's a mistake. The second is to stop imagining that we run the world. Nobody runs the world, neither the natural world nor the human world. It's possible that global warming won't happen. Maybe global climate will shift for some unrelated reason. Maybe solar power will get so cheap that we'll stop burning oil and gas. Other things could happen. But if none of those happen, and if the current climate models are right, global warming is going to happen. That we ought to face the poverty of our circumstances. We ought to realize that things are going to happen that we may not like, and think not about how do we stop things happening, but how do we live with our best guess of what the future is going to be. It's going to be like. And this isn't limited to environmentalist stuff. I published a book a few years ago called Future Imperfect, which was basically about technological revolutions that might happen in my lifetime and their implications. And there also I was arguing that the world was radically uncertain, and that mostly, even though some of the revolutions had potential downsides much, much larger than global warming. When I spoke on the book at Google, I told them that I thought global warming was a pretty wimpy catastrophe because I could kill off the world's population faster than that. In various hypothetical technological scenarios. We can't control the Earth's climate. We can't control other people. The world is full of billions of people, each with his own dreams, his own objectives, his own knowledge, and we can't go to all of them and say, you got to stop it, do what we want. It's not going to happen. That one reason we won't stop India is stop global warming is that although the developed world is very rich, it is not rich enough to bribe India and China into staying poor. So even if we assume solid environmentalist governments in the Western Europe and the U.S., the amount they will be willing to offer those countries to not use fossil fuels isn't going to be enough. That's a prediction. We'll see if I'm right. They'll be happy to take our money, of course, but they won't be happy to do is to stop using fossil fuels. And on the whole, I think that's a good thing. On the whole, I don't want to have a world where there's somebody in charge. All right? Everybody feels like there ought to be someone in charge, maybe me, right? But I'd rather have a world where different people have different views, pursue different objectives, and sometimes they do things I think are a mistake. That's too bad. But that's better than the world that I think is sort of the dream in the back of the heads of an awful lot of reformers, of the world where somehow I figure out what we should do, and you all go out and do it. All right. I think that basically finishes this. I want to thank the people who organized this project for responding to my raising my issues, not by telling me to go shut up, but by offering me a room and a time to give this talk. And that really finishes what I have to say here. But I would be more than happy to take any questions. Someone else is supposed to be using this room. They asked me to finish by this time. And if nobody else shows up, we can talk here. If someone else shows up, we can talk outside.